Welcome to another episode of Discover Ag, brought to you in part by Case IH. We're your hosts, Natalie, a rancher and pharmacist from Nebraska.
And I'm Tara, a dairy farmer and environmental scientist from New Mexico. And together we bring you our professional farming opinions on a variety of trending topics in the ag and food space so that you can better understand our food system and feel connected to the hands that feed us. Hi, I haven't seen you in 12 hours. It's been a long time.
I know. We were, if you caught stories, we were just together basking in a wonderful couple's vacation in Florida. But I left this morning because I got to go to Texas and partake in Ag Week here at Texas Tech University, and they kicked it off with actually an extremely awesome panel tonight. I am leaving on, like, you know, high endorphin vibes from tonight's panel. So it's very fun.
I know. I cannot believe that you are speaking an hour and a half from where I live and I'm not seeing you. And the reason I'm not seeing you is because I'm flying straight from Florida to Kentucky to give a speech tomorrow. So we're just, like, in different, we were together, now we're in different places. But I will say, our couples trip, I don't know if you felt this way, but I feel like as adults, a lot of your friendships are, we should really get together soon. Like, we should do something fun. And I feel like this trip was like, we did it. We made it happen. We got our husbands together. We had a weekend away without kids. And it was just, like, good for the soul.
You had mentioned, it came up sometime on the vacation about when we started planning it. And I was like, we planned it that long ago? I couldn't believe I committed to it that long ago, but I did. I'm so proud of myself.
I'm really proud of us too. Like, we started planning in April. It's September. Like, it took a lot to make this happen. Listen, to get a dairy farmer, a cattle rancher, and a calf rancher to take off was quite an undertaking.
I feel like we could turn that into a joke. Yeah, like, it's like a dairy farmer, a calf rancher, and a rancher all fly to the state of Florida.
They all walked into a beach.
Bar.
A beach bar.
That's a true story. They all walked into a bar. True story.
Oh, no. It was such a good trip. I feel like we ate all the food. Let me just say that. Would you know? I mean, listen, if you guys are discos, you know I'm the foodie.
Are we even shocked?
I know. I'm a food junkie. And I just drug you all along.
Well, I have a lot to say about the articles. So do we want to keep yammering or do we want to dive into things?
I have one more thing to yammer about. That pre-vacation.
I love yammering.
It's important. It's food related. Can I tell you what I did for the very first time in my entire adult life? Or my entire life. Adult
and
or
I don't
childhood.
Know yet.
I don't think you know. I don't think I talked about it.
Sometimes we intentionally keep things from each other so we can talk about it fresh on the podcast. And then I'm like, should I be hurt that I don't know about it? Or is this just business strategy?
No, we just have to keep good content for the listeners. So I did online grocery store pickup.
Oh, I saw your stories on that actually.
It was wild. It was the wildest thing I've ever done. I literally sat online, picked out my groceries, and then I drove up and a man came out with a cart and put him in my car. I know that doesn't sound like a shock to people who do that, but like but I felt awkward. Do I tip him? Do I not tip him? We've talked about tipping before. I did not know what to do.
I'm curious how'd you rate it?
So it was a smaller grocery store run because it was before vacation. So I just wanted to get food for the babysitter to have with the girls. I don't know that maybe I'd get better at it, but I would say I'm a very much like in the moment grocery shopper, not like a meal planner prepper. Like I'm like, ooh, yeah, let's get that. That's what we're going to have for dinner this week. Whereas I feel like with online shopping, you kind of have to have like, here's what we're having for the next few days. Plan out your meals, get it done.
So it saved you time, though.
10 out of 10 on convenience.
Uh-huh.
But it was less spur of the moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious. I did a poll on my stories, and I'm clearly in the minority. Most people have done grocery store pickup.
I was going to say I have never done it, and I'm not sure if I see it in my future, honestly.
Yeah. So that's all I have to add, but I think we should get into more stuff because we have an exciting episode. We are actually ending this episode with another one of our mini interviews with Case IH, and it is more content from Farm Progress, and it's really good. It's our live interview we recorded on stage.
Yeah, we got to sit down with Joe Miller, who is Case IH's global product manager, which I basically just say is a fancy way of calling him the tractor expert. And he talked to us all about the electric tractor that they rolled out at Farm Progress. And we just had a really fascinating conversation, I think, about like the future of a little bit of the future of agriculture as a whole, but obviously the future of tractors. And I have to tell you, he knows his stuff. He was very knowledgeable, very well spoken. I'm really excited to bring this interview to you guys.
Yeah. So as always, this episode of Discover Ag is brought to you in part by Case IH. To the men and women at Case IH, farming is a way of life, a life they live every day on millions of acres across North America. Get to know the farmers who work at Case IH and see how they bring that perspective into everything Case IH does. Visit builtbyfarmers.com to see their stories and to even share your own. Built by Farmers, Case IH, a proud sponsor of the Discover Ag podcast.
Okay. Getting into our discovery word of the week. Are you guys ready?
I'm ready. Drum roll.
Bosky. 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 Bosky.
Bosky.
Yeah, that's not a new word for me.
It's not?
I live in New Mexico. Bosky.
I have never heard it in my entire life.
My brother-in-law lives on the Bosky.
Okay.
Do you know what it is?
What? Well, yeah, I'm looking at it. So yes, I know what it is, but I'm curious how you guys use it because I'm not entirely sure.
Because we don't have a lot of rivers. It's the area of like wooded greenery near a river, like the river valley.
So it doesn't have to be associated with water. It's just an adjective for filled with bushes, trees, and dense vegetation, heavily wooded.
Okay. Yep. That's what I would say. But I feel like ours are in reference to near a river, which is surprising since we don't have a lot of rivers in New Mexico.
I was going to say, you don't have water.
Right. No water, but we apparently still have bosques.
Okay. Moving to the first article you need to discover this week, titled Organic Food Sector Experts Expects 15% Growth, Provoking Debate Over Price Justification. Is it worth paying higher prices for organic foods, especially during a time of significant inflation? Take away the stats because I know you're ready to drop some stats.
I do, but I actually want to start in a different place. I'm sorry to disappoint again, but this article, you put it in our like queue of things we could cover, and it actually comes from Morning Ag Clips. But I was interested in it because I have been doing a ton of research and just hearing a ton of information about organic milk sales and how stagnant they are. And so to see an article that was titled Organic Growth really surprised me because that's not what I've been hearing from the organic milk side of things.
Yeah. I mean, the article starts off by kicking it off with a couple stats about how much expected to grow the organic sector by $310 billion, which is not a small amount, which is a nearly a 16% increase. And that's obviously coming with a higher price tag compared to conventional foods. The organic food and beverage market is estimated to cost roughly 21% more than their conventional counterparts, which I'm a little shocked by 21%. That's quite a bit of difference.
Yeah, and the farmers say it's because of higher production costs, you know, associated with organic, a lot more labor intensive, which I think we can, that makes sense. There's a lot more labor if you're not using pesticides, obviously growing foods without GMO or having to feed livestock that are organic without GMO. And so that's what they're saying, like justifies their cost increases.
Yeah, and I do think that is one thing that needs to be brought to the conversation more when we have a lot of people advocating for a decrease in GMOs. When you do have GMOs, then you are able to decrease the amount of, you know, pesticide, herbicide, all of those chemicals that maybe some people aren't a fan of. That's a pro side to the GMO conversation.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a double whammy, I feel like, for organic farmers. They cannot use they can use pesticides, but they cannot use synthetic pesticides is the difference. And then you are also not having GMO crops. So it is – some of the numbers, though, were kind of crazy. Here, I'll bring in some stats now. Especially in the animal protein sector is where you see the biggest difference. So Amazon Fresh was where they were kind of doing their research. So going to that online grocery shopping, a regular chicken breast was under $5 or $5 per pound, sorry. And organic was over $10 per pound. So you're talking about a massive difference. They said, though, that if you exclude meat, the organics is not as big of a difference. It's more like a 10% increase in the cost.
So once it kind of laid out some of that groundwork, the article then went in to talk a little bit about why there is maybe some beef with the idea of paying more, just because two of the reasons people are paying, you know, choosing to shop organic is, in my mind, would be environmental health. And maybe we could dive into maybe some misconceptions of that, or is it worth it? Kind of that conversation, because that's what the article moved into essentially.
Yeah, before moving into maybe some of the downsides, I feel like the supporters are kind of, it's like interesting to hear their thoughts. They will say that the more people who get on board, the lower it brings the price down. Like those farmers that are getting like an organic premium may not get as much of a premium as more and more national grocery stores demand it. And so obviously by bringing down the price, you're increasing the availability. So that was some of the supporters. I guess maybe you can take it away with the opposite side of that.
Yeah. So when it comes to the safety side of it, or I guess the health side of it, the USDA and FDA and the EPA say that crops sprayed with pesticides are safe for human consumption. Those two regulatory bodies work together to determine the legal limit of pesticides deemed safe for nutrition. And I just think a lot of people believe that organic foods are more nutritious than conventional foods, but through research and support, this claim has really been shown to be lacking. So when you kind of really dive into it, I mean, you guess you'd say like an apple is an apple, you know, so you're not getting any more nutrition when you choose that organic counterpart. So you have to ask yourself, is that 21% increase or sometimes even more actually worth it if you're going for the nutritious side of it?
I was really happy to see they brought on an RD, a registered dietitian, to talk about the fruits and vegetables and how like getting fruits and vegetables, kind of similar to some of the conversation we've had about like getting beef is good for you. Getting fruits and vegetables is good for you. If you choose to then like pick a certain kind, like that's a choice you make. But like the nutrition there, like the RD was like, you're going to get nutritious fruits and vegetables no matter what price point they're at, which I don't know. I was glad they included that, like I guess, side of the conversation.
Yeah. And that nutritionist went on to say that the organic only messaging could potentially harm the public. She brought up the CDC reports that 1 in 10 Americans do not consume the recommended amounts of fruits and vegetables daily. And we kind of talked about that the last time we talked about this. We actually talked about the EWG, and I'm not sure if we want to dive into that. We definitely could. But it's definitely shown to prove that people get that into their mind when they're shopping. And then if they can't buy the organic, they just don't buy it. And at the end of the day, I think that's very harmful, especially when these studies show that some of the pesticides sprayed on there, if not all, most of the pesticides sprayed on there are within the limit of safe.
Yeah. I mean, on the critic side, for sure, it's you're hurting access to fruits and vegetables for low-income families, which is, I mean, that's something we need to take into consideration when choosing our food and talking about our food system. As far as the environmental working group, I'm glad you brought them up. I've said that I'm not like their biggest fan. I know I feel like you sometimes have used their website for different things. I feel like we have kind of different viewpoints on that. And we have talked about the EWG before. We talked about them on episode 81, actually, way, way back. I think that feels like an eternity ago, but we talked about the Dirty Dozen. And so one of the people they interviewed was a woman who said, I can't afford to buy all organic. So I use the Environmental Working Group's list of the Dirty Dozen to pick my fruits. And in that episode, we talk about some of the problems with the Dirty Dozen, that it's not always based on science and it's not based on limits or really anything. It's just they're putting out numbers that can really scare people on what is okay and what's, you know, acceptable and not acceptable.
Yeah, they say the EWG analysis is misleading because it essentially counts all detections equally. So it ignores what chemical it is, at what level it was detected. And then they basically just compare that to the crop chemical, like specific EPA tolerances. And so they're kind of just saying like these apples have pesticides on them and they have the most pesticides on them, but they're not putting that into, you know, context. Essentially, the EWG, when it comes to the Dirty Dozen, is really missing context. And that's kind of the most important piece.
Right. There's no like, you know, the limit, like safety limits. It's just like, here's this number. It's a big number or it's not. I mean, it's kind of just sometimes a number. They're not giving any like fact-based information about it. Yeah, I don't know.
I actually read a really interesting article. It was in Forbes in 2018. It's called The Truth About Pesticide Residues on Produce. I was turned on by Caroline Nelson, so I cannot claim that I'm the one who found it. But it was very interesting, one, that it was even coming from the Forbes, and then two, what it was written about. They evaluated the USDA's annual pesticide data program, the PDP, and essentially what this does, it looks at chemical residues on various commodities in the U.S. food supply. Essentially what it correlates to is that 99.85% of the residues that were detected are below the already conservative tolerances. And so they summed it up by saying like our farmers do a really good job of supplying our produce and doing a great job at protecting yield and quality from pest damage, but in a way that's safe for us. And they said, we are fortunate consumers. And I was just literally shocked by this.
They actually gave some credit to the farmers. I feel like sometimes when there's good things in about our food system, the farmers don't always get credit. So thanks to the produce and vegetable farmers out there for like doing the most and producing nutritious products for us to enjoy.
One of the quotes I like, they interviewed a small farmer and she said that to stretch her tiny food budget, to make organic choices for her family, she said she, you know, joined like a CSA and that she grows and cans some of her own vegetables and that they are trying to raise, you know, meat on their own homestead. And I just thought it was a really interesting way to look at, you know, quote unquote, buying organic. Like I liked the idea that they took and highlighted someone who was trying to shop healthier, but didn't attach it to any labels. Like they gave some actual examples of things you could do that's not a label because, you know, you and I, we don't like labels. We could get on our label soapbox and talk about them day in and day out. And I just thought it was really great that she was like, I joined a CSA. 100%. I love that. Join a CSA if you can. Like, don't rely and fall back on those labels. Like, there's a lot of other things you could do to shop like healthy that isn't falling prey to like the victims or the labels in the grocery store aisles.
Yeah, I would second that. Once again, Morning Ag Clips had a great, well-rounded article that brought in a lot of different perspectives from a lot of different sides. You could not leave this saying it was pro-organic or pro-conventional. It was laying it all out there for with a lot of different viewpoints. So I really appreciated that. Okay, before we move on to our second article, I want to tell you, do you know what email I got today in my inbox? It was a very happy email.
I do because I got the same one. It's our Good Ranchers email.
I know. Did you get, we're getting bacon. I'm out of bacon.
And we're getting some good cuts of steaks too.
I am pork. We're getting pork chops. We haven't got to try their pork yet. I haven't tried it, or I haven't. I guess I can't speak for you. I've tried their bacon, which is obviously pork, but I haven't tried one of their cuts of pork, and I am so flipping excited. So that is goodranchers.com, you guys. If you haven't yet, you can subscribe, get a subscription box. You can now get your beef, your pork, and your seafood delivered right to your door, and it is American meat delivered. And our code right now, Discover, is worth $25 off any box.
We actually tried we got a seafood order, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, and Luke pulled out their shrimp to try, and we tried their shrimp, and I was very impressed. So like Tara said, it's across the board. We have all access to all the proteins now, and you know that they're supporting 100% U.S. farmers and ranchers. And then I also love that they give back. You guys, they give back for every box that's purchased, and they're just, you know, we love our Good Ranchers.
I know. The last thing I'll say about them is don't forget about their bonus going on right now. They get 2 pounds of high quality Angus ground beef in every single one of your boxes for the next 2 years. This is a $480 value free for subscriptions. So again, go to goodranchers.com and use our code Discover for $25 off your next box.
All right, moving into the second headline you need to discover this week, titled The Making of the U.S. Open's Food Village. Each year, the Billie Jean King Tennis Center in Queens hosts not only a premier tennis tournament, but a festival-like village complete with food, drinks, shopping, and music.
Take it away, Natalie. I told you I wasn't sure where you were headed with this one. You said I have a lot to say, so.
Oh, I loved it so much. I feel like tennis is very trending right now. It's all over social media. And I did not know a lot about the U.S. Open. So when I saw this kind of highlighting the Food Village component of it, I thought it was so cool. So the tournament is, there's 17 courts to play on, you guys. There's over 600 athletes, 7,000 workers, 300 staffers. There is over 900,000 attendees, which just blows my absolute mind. But on top of that, it's not just a tennis tournament. It is a food and wine festival. And I just feel like this should be right up your alley, Tara. You should love this.
Yeah, they compared it to the circus coming to town for 3 weeks. They give some really crazy stats about how, you said it's like a million people. There's also 1,000 media in attendance from all over the entire world, which is kind of crazy. But they compared it to basically the entire NBA, like all of the people watching basketball for the entire season being in one place for a week, 2 weeks. What did you say it is? 2.5 weeks, I think is how many weeks it is. That's kind of wild. And you have to feed all of those people. And so I was going through their list of foods. I was checking the menus on everybody. You can eat anything you want at the U.S. Open.
They're sitting there watching through lunch and dinner. And so 40% of the guests are actually international. And so they're looking for food flavors of New York, not the traditional stadium fare. So the US Open actually partners with a lot of local chefs and restaurants so they can get a really good mix of foods. And I thought it was so cool. Like they have a renowned seafood restaurant there. It's been there for 17 years. He was actually the first chef to join. But then they go on to having like sushi, and they have like a James Beard Award winner there, which is like one of NYC's Tatiana restaurants. Like there's Latin flares, and it was, I don't know. I'm like, this is a food court I could get down with.
You talked about who they partnered with. You know who one person they partner with is?
I do.
Grey Goose.
Grey Goose.
They serve.
You made one.
I made one. I made one of the drinks, you guys. It is a honeydew. Let me taste it. I haven't tasted it yet.
Honey deuce.
It's honeydew. Oh, sorry. Honeydew. Thank you.
Yes.
I said it wrong.
So it's named for the tie score of 40-40 known in tennis as deuce.
That makes sense.
Yes. And it has been the official cocktail of the Open since 2006. And I'm so excited to talk about this because, you guys, I love a good theme. If there's nothing I don't love, it is a good theme.
It's really good. Bartender Daniel stirred it up for me right before when I was setting up. I told him what it consisted of. And it's actually really tasty.
Yeah, the Kentucky Derby has the mint julep, the Wimbledon has the Pimm's Cup, and the U.S. Open has the honeydew. So it is a combination of vodka, lemonade, and raspberry liqueur. And then like Tara said, the reason why she said honeydew, is because they actually cut little
melons,
like tennis balls out of the honeydew and then place those on skewers on top of it. The mind behind it was a guy by Nick Matoon. He was a former managing partner at this tavern. And he said he wanted to create a drink that was tart and fruity and that would appeal to both men and women. He said he also wanted to incorporate some elements of tennis, such as the color of the court and the balls. And since, like you said, since inception in 2007, the US Open has served over 1.8 million honeydew cocktails.
I'm not going to lie. When I was like scrolling through the menu, there was like a pizza place that looked amazing. And then, I mean, I was all about the sushi. But if you followed Natalie's stories this weekend, Natalie doesn't like sushi. So I doubt you were scoping out the sushi restaurants at the US Open, but I was. They looked amazing.
No, but I did see that they have an ice cream chain there that is exclusive flavor for the 2023 tournament. It's called the Honeycomb Fudge Slam. Which again, I just love a good theme name, like the Fudge Slam. So you can have the sushi and I'll have the ice cream.
That's fine. We put it on our goal for coming years is to bring Discover Ag live from the US Open. So we're going to get there, Natalie.
We're going to manifest that. We are going to be your two food correspondents next year, and we're going to interview the chefs and talk about where they're sourcing their food from. And so anyone who is listening from the US Open.
It's somebody out there is.
Grey Goose vodka. Yep. Really anyone at all.
Anyone.
We're your two girlies.
We're here for you. We're happy to donate 3 weeks of our time to go to the US Open and eat all of the food.
Speaking of donating, one crazy fact I read is that the US Open gives 100% of their proceeds go back into building the game of tennis in the States. And I thought that was just actually crazy.
I loved that too. I had no idea. It's a nonprofit. Like you think about all of the NBA, like all of the major league teams or sports, I don't know, that it's obviously for profit and the US Open is not. They said it used to be like known, tennis was known for being like a country club sport. Like it was a rich sport. And they're saying that has changed. Most of tennis is being played on public courts across the United States. And so all of the money goes to like improving those public courts, more access to public courts. I loved that. I thought that was really fascinating. Okay. Before we move into our next article, we want to shout out one of our favorite podcasts. We talked about them a couple weeks ago, that Barn Talk podcast. We actually got the chance to meet Torque, which is one of the co-hosts of the Barn Talk podcast. And it is a father-son duo that hosts a weekly podcast. And they are bringing all sorts of education, inspiration, and like very comical. They are very humorous podcast. And I will attest to that. We had dinner with Torque, one of the co-hosts, as I said, and he was hysterical. So I love it. I love their social media content. I love their podcast. They do such a great job. So if you guys like agriculture podcast, go give Barn Talk a listen as well.
The other thing we want to highlight, you guys, is we need to remind you of our monthly giveaway, which we have not done in a really long time. So anytime you leave us a review or share and tag us on social media channels, you are entered for that month's giveaway. And we have a pretty cool package that we send the winner at the end of the month. So if you are listening today and you're enjoying the Discover experience, please share us to stories, leave us a review, do anything you can to help, you know, spread the message of the Discover Ag podcast and help us reach new listeners.
We had the sweetest one from this week that it was one of our male listeners. He's a dad, a granddad, and a great granddad. And he has been listening to Discover Ag for a year, and it was the sweetest review. So thank you.
That review really did mean a lot to me. So I'm sure he's tuning in today. Thank you so much. All right, getting into the last and final headline to discover this week, pork industry grapples with the whiplash of shifting regulations. Retailers in California and pig farmers and processors thousands of miles away are bracing for the impact of a state ban on some sources of the meat.
I'm going to give a little history in case people haven't been following this. If you've been listening to Discover Ag, you probably have been following it, but I still think it has a long history and it's worth noting. California passed Prop 12 in 2018, and it outlawed small gestational crates for hogs. It also had some measures for poultry as well, but the hogs part of the story is what has really, you know, captivated, I feel like, headlines. But the issue was it didn't just affect the state of California. You can't sell your pork into California unless you follow the rules. California consumes 15% of the nation's porks, but actually produces very little. So this is going to have a big impact on other states. And it actually made it all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ended up upholding California's ruling, and it was going into effect in July, or so we thought. And that leads us to now.
Yeah. So one of the first sound bites was from a gentleman who is a meat and seafood coordinator for a market in California. And he said, there is so much murky water here. They're supposed to be compliant as of July 1st, but I don't think the state has any teeth on the enforcement side of things. Companies aren't taking it seriously as they should. And at some point the state will make an example out of them. So it's just kind of like, well, like the headline said, it's just whiplash for everyone.
Yeah, they had an interview from a farm out of Texas who, when this first got passed, their phones were ringing off the hook with California grocery stores wanting to buy their pork because they complied with the new laws. And they said it hasn't been that simple because there just is not a lot of enforcement. There is still a lot of fighting going on. One of the quotes was, the pork industry isn't done fighting. There are senators from a lot of different Midwestern states that are actually trying to introduce legislation, the Ending Agricultural Trade Suppression Act, and that would limit the ability of states to regulate agriculture in other states. So if like that passes, so a lot of grocery stores, like you said, a lot of buyers are not ready to jump in with like both feet until they know what's actually going to happen.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that that it ended up being where it's at. Like that it wasn't a clean transition. People didn't comply. There was no backlash. Like that, I'm not surprised that producers are continuing to fight. I mean, I would have seen this in my crystal ball.
If you want to go back and listen to a little bit more about this, I think it's worth noting that we did cover this with the American Farm Bureau president, Zippy Duval, on November 8th. And they are one of the people who actually took it to the Supreme Court. The American Farm Bureau did. And then we covered it also October 20th in our episode titled, Can California Do That? So if you want a little more history, you want to hear what American Farm Bureau's opinion was, those are two really great episodes to listen to.
So one of the things that I would assume we talked about this when we covered it, but I guess I can't for sure remember. I pretty much black out when we talk about podcasts, so I never remember what we say or do. But one thing I know we have talked about, at least in personal conversation, if not on the podcast already, is that things like this come with the ripple effect of maybe being too expensive for the small guy to adapt to and further leading to consolidation. That was something that the article highlighted and pointed out. And I think that is one of the things that the people voting on never think about. And so I always love to bring it to the forefront of the conversation again, you guys. The numbers they were using in here are, this one was $8.7 million to spend to make the new facility, and it modifies existing one to meet. That's what a pig farmer that they interviewed, he was a fourth generation farmer in Iowa, was saying. And you guys, $8.7 million for any business is a lot. So to think that we can just make these changes at the drop of the hat with the July 1st, you know, deadline, it's astounding to me.
Yeah. And like you said, without enforcement, the guy, this farmer was saying, he's from Iowa. He said that the packing company right now is barely paying him a small premium over market-priced hogs. So he said it's going to take him more than 10 years to recoup those costs. And it, with all the uncertainty, he's just not sure it's going to be worth it. I don't know. I just don't think we always know the ramifications of decisions that we make. And I think that was why this got so heated and debated. It's like, you know, our title of that last podcast that we covered on this was, Can California Do That? And it was kind of like, can California make a law that dictates how other farmers in other states have to comply with things?
I think another unintended consequence when we vote on things like this and don't maybe consider all the ripple effects is, one, the availability. So, you know, if other states stop shipping to California, what does that actually mean for pork consumption in California? Are they going to even have availability? But even more importantly than that, the price of it. This will be a very great case model to study to see if consumers are actually willing to pay for what they say they are going to pay for. Because a lot of times we all say we want to know, you know, where it comes from or what the label says, or we want these different practices. But then when it comes down to game time decision in the grocery store, your kids are screaming, you got bills to pay, which one do they actually go to grab? And that was one of the quotes that I thought was really interesting. One of the farmers said, the idea of having a large capital expenditure with no clear payback doesn't make sense to us. We don't know what sort of premium these pigs will get. We don't know if people will be buying them.
Yeah. And if it's mandated, will it even really be a premium? Do you know, or will it just be another cost the farmers have to kind of like take on? I mean, as a lot of farmers are price takers, not price makers. So it's not like we can be like, oh, but it cost us this much more to raise a hog this year, so we're going to charge that much more to the grocery store. Like, that's not the way it works. And so they talked about, like, will, you know, something like bacon or pork chops become a luxury item in California that you simply, there's, you know, farmers are going to opt out of not doing it. And there could be a short supply in California and push prices too high, push it out of people's price range. And so that's what I kept wondering is, will there just be less pork in California?
I kind of think there probably will have to be.
Another point of this that I got a little fired up about at the very end of my research was, what about imported pork? Is anyone having a conversation about that? Like, how will that be regulated? Or is this going to be another instance where we import a product that undercuts our American farmers that are having to comply with these regulations, but we can bring in pork that doesn't have to comply with them? And I know imports and exports are a sticky business, and that, you know, it's a needed thing that we have imports and exports, but I just worry about what's going to happen in that part of this conversation.
It'll be really interesting to see how this even moves forward. I have a feeling it's going to be very slow. I don't think we're going to see any like major changes anytime soon, I don't think, but it will be interesting to see how California starts mandating this, like kind of what the next, you know, play in the chess game is.
I agree. And I know that we have already covered this a couple times, but I think it's been a fascinating case to study. I'm sure the hog farmers maybe listening might feel differently about it. But it has been just kind of interesting to follow. So I think it'll be something that we do kind of continue to watch and see what happens, because I think it has real, that's why it made it to the Supreme Court, is because it has real consequences for lots of different agricultural trades. I mean, the interstate commerce part of this conversation, we touched on that a lot with President Zippy Duval, that we're not touching on today. But this could just go so far beyond just hogs. Okay, I think that wraps us up for our articles today, but you guys continue listening because we have a really jam-packed mini interview with Case IH, one of our sponsors of Discover Ag. It was a fascinating conversation live from the stage at Farm Progress. So tune in now. So today we are in the middle of Farm Progress, day two of Farm Progress. But actually this entire event started for me back on Monday, where I attended a Case IH event that was kind of an unveiling, a little preview of what you guys now have here. Can you tell us what these big announcements were? I mean, I got the full experience. I got to do the ride in the tractor, but what all are you guys announcing this week?
We've really had so many new things that we're talking about here. And we started off probably the first of the year, FarmAlt's 100 years, right? 100 year anniversary of FarmAlt. And so as we got talking about that, though, there's so much more happening than Farmall. And you mentioned it with the event we started Monday, and I was out there for a little bit as well. And that was the unveiling of the new Steiger 715, which is back to my behind me right here on the right. That tractor is the most powerful four-wheel drive tractor in the industry. 715 horsepower, 778 peak. And it took the mantle as the most powerful tractor away from the 645 Steiger, which is off to my left. So a lot of horsepower leadership, a lot of track leadership, a lot of innovative styling, digital enhancements in the cab. So all of those things are very important. And it was really cool to see kind of that first peek that we did prior to the show. So it was a lot of fun.
It was funny. Yesterday, Natalie saw the one that is to our left. And for people listening, I mean, these things are huge. The one to our left that's smaller is huge. And so Natalie saw it and asked if that was the one I drove. And I said, no, the one I got to drive was bigger. And she wasn't sure she trusted me out on the tractor.
No, it was great. I think you did a great job. And we had we did have specialists out there just to help with any questions and make sure that everyone felt comfortable. But we are going to be doing that all week. So we have four tractors out there running right now.
That's amazing. It's amazing too on the 100 years. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it was a fun thing because I said, man, it's 100 years of Farmall. And we got to talk. I said, you only turn 100 one time, right? So let's go ahead and let's blow it up. And knowing some of the cool stuff we had coming, it's like, let's celebrate for about 8 months about what Farmall has been. And then let's turn the page and talk about where we're headed in the future.
So speaking of that, you know, you dropped a lot of big words about horsepower and numbers that I think probably excite a lot of the tractor people. One thing that excites Tara and I that we talk a lot about on this podcast is sustainability. Mm-hmm. I think that's at the forefront of a lot of producers' minds, farmers, ranchers across the nation. You know, it's something we care deeply about when it comes to our own individual operations. So I think one of the big questions is, how do these tractors, these big, bad pieces of equipment, you know, how does that impact the sustainability of your guys' products?
So when we talk about the Steigers in particular, they're all coming out with the new ones here are going to be stage 5 emissions compliant. So they are very, very clean burning diesel engines. The other thing with the horsepower leadership, it used to be, you know, horsepower is a lot about bragging rights and being able to implement the deepest.
Right on cue.
Yeah. But more than that, the horsepower is used now from even sustainability is how do we take the same amount of time, the same amount of diesel inputs and things like that to spread them over more acres in that same hour of productivity. So it's either wider implements or you're running faster. And all of those we're going to reduce the number of times that the engine's running and, you know, it reduce the amount of CO2 emissions. With our stage 5 diesel exhaust fluid, all of that stuff that we're using, we are emitting very, very clean burning diesel engines. And we've been pioneering that SCR technology for really, man, I had to go back in time, but since that's the mid-2000s. So it's a very important part of our business as well.
I love that you kind of started this, that you are reflecting back on all you guys have accomplished in the last 100 years and really like that heritage, but also like looking to the future. One of the things you guys unrolled is the electric Farmall. As a dairy farmer who is currently installing solar panels, this is really attractive to me. Actually, after the announcement, I called my husband yesterday and was like, man, what would that be like for, you know, some of our tractors if we have that extra solar power that we're going to our barn that you could pull up with your tractor, plug it in, and then our tractors would be running off the solar panels too. So really, you know, what does that look like for those electric vehicles that you guys are rolling out?
Well, I mean, you hit a kind of a neat topic with your background in dairy, because one of the things with these tractors, that, I mean, there's zero emissions, right? I mean, a full battery electric tractor. So the ability to even go into freestall barns or buildings, and there is no emissions. You don't have to worry about any CO2 emissions with your animals. So there's different poultry applications, different cattle applications where just going inside the building, number one, it's pretty quiet. So it won't disrupt the cows or won't, you know, I don't want to say spook them, but, you know, it might help them stay a little bit calmer. But additionally, there's just no emissions inside. The other thing is, I think this talks about the diversity of applications in agriculture, because in certain applications, customers are going to want that battery electric. They're going to have the ability with solar power or maybe different generator capabilities, right? So they can plug that tractor in and that's really sustainable for their farm. Some other areas might say, well, I still prefer having a diesel solution. That's fine. We'll provide you a very clean burning diesel solution and we'll do with whatever works out for our customers. The 75C electric tractor is our first venture into an all-electric tractor. It's very cool. I don't know how else to describe it technically. It's a really cool product. You have instant power, instant torque. The runtime varies a little bit based on the load, not unlike a diesel engine. So the fact that we build it on a current 75C tractor, the operation and the controls very similar to what customers are used to. So it's a really easy way to transition to that different technology.
I think the word cool is a technical term, right? Like, yeah, it's very cool. Like, I mean, is there anything else to say besides that?
I was going to say my ears perked up a little bit when you said quiet. We have an old 8910 on our operation. And every time you turn on the air conditioner or the heater, it is so loud. I'm like, I think we could probably use the upgrade of some of the features that come with this new tractor. And like you said, it is really exciting when we get to this point. You mentioned that it was like a Case's first venture into something in this territory. And I think that comes with a lot of excitement. I think it also comes with a lot of maybe a little hesitancy from people. So I think the big question we'd all really have is, you know, these look great. There's a lot of highlight points under them. How do they actually perform compared to a diesel tractor then?
So the cool, I guess I'll give you some performance things. We did some testing. I did some testing on this tractor a year ago, and it didn't look nearly as finished as it does now. But we've been working on this tractor for a period of time. And when it got to pure performance, the way the tractor was set up, we had a mule kind of set up to pull, okay? And it would provide a load to the situation. And so we backed up a diesel tractor, and they said, engineering said, set it in this gear, put it in this range, this many RPM, release the clutch, right, and drag it forward. And when we started that load, the engine kind of pulled down like a diesel wheel and it recovered, but you could tell that we'd grabbed a hold of something and it was a load. So they said, okay, now unhook that, put the battery electric tractor on. So we did that. And they said, same RPMs, same everything, because you actually set the drive motor RPMs, just like a regular engine. It's just electric motor instead of a diesel electric.
Or
diesel.
I'm nodding like I know exactly.
I know. What I was just seeing the same thing.
I'm sorry. Okay. I tried.
So, I got it. I know how to operate it now.
Electric motor instead of diesel motor. We'll just go with that. And when we set it up there, they said, okay, put it same RPMs. I did. And they said, release the clutch. And the tractor just took off. No hesitant, nothing, right? It was just there. And then they kind of blew my mind. They said, now put it at low idle. Idle it down. It was 800 RPM. And they said, same trick. Now that just about killed the diesel tractor. I released the clutch and the tractor took off like it was, there was nothing there. And the point to that is with a battery electric tractor, you have instant power, instant torque. It's always live and it's always at max. So the performance was from a person who's grown up on a Angus cattle farm in Northern Indiana. And now we've transitioned to all corn and soybeans. I can tell you that I was blown away with just how well that tractor handled loader work, how well it handled drawbar work. And I left there, even though it was a mule tractor or an engineering development tractor, I was just blown away. I said, that's one of the most impressive tractors a customer will buy.
Yeah. So I think one of the questions that I kind of keep asking myself is why now, which I know you guys have been working on this for a long time. It's not like you snapped your fingers and then suddenly had an electric vehicle or electric lineup. I would guess it probably has to do with some of our coastlines and different areas that different states that are putting a lot of pressure on our farmers across a lot of different industries, but especially on farmers for reducing emissions. So is, you know, what were you guys seeing from getting pressure as far as needing to provide these farmers with new tools, new vehicles that would help them reach these emission standards?
Yeah, I think, Tara, it's a great question. It's been on our radar. And what's really cool about what we've done with the battery electric tractor was we've done a lot of things together with our sister brand, New Holland, as well as Case Construction. Case has had an electric tractor loader backhoe and now a full electric mini excavator. New Holland's got their T4 electric tractor. And what we've done together collectively is we work with CNH Industrial is our parent company is a strong arm to talk about what do we need to do to provide service, which is different for a battery electric tractor than it is on a diesel engine. What are we going to do to provide parts? What's the charging going to look like, right? How are we going to handle some of these infrastructure challenges? Not so much like the grid, but understanding how we're going to support this new type of technology. That became just as important as to put a battery in a tractor and have it drive that way wasn't as difficult as making sure that we had the right technical expertise and support to help operators once they did it.
No, the infrastructure piece is really, I'm glad you brought that up, actually. I had not planned on touching on that, but I'm glad you did because it was actually something I was thinking through yesterday. Like, okay, so if we did do this with solar panels and we did add an electric vehicle, where are we parking them? Where are we plugging them in at? How does that affect the current operations of when we need to get trailers in and out? And so it is a big piece that you've got to work through. It's a change to your operation that you're going to have to think through kind of the pros and cons and where you're going to install the infrastructure for that for your farm.
You're exactly right. And when you talk about, you know, where and why now, that was some of the table stakes that we had to make sure we understood. The other thing we saw that there were going to be different pockets of the country that were going to say, and the world, because this is, we're bringing out different regions of the world as well, that they're going to say, hey, from a to plug it into, or we're going to, states are going to say for government work, municipalities, mowing roadsides. It's not just the livestock producer, the crop producer. It could be government groups saying, you know what, we don't have a choice. We need to buy something that is an alternate solution if it's available. So there was an opportunity there to lead and again, meet our customers where they are and where they're headed. So the battery electric was one tool in that arsenal that we want to bring forward.
So speaking of meeting us where we're headed, I think in agriculture, we have a couple favorite P words, performance and profitability. Mm-hmm. That ranks high for probably anyone across the board. So can you talk a little bit about how those go hand in hand with the Steiger and what that looks like from, you know, a performance, agronomic performance, you know, standpoint?
Absolutely. The Steiger, we talk about the 715, which is the new one. And really, I say the 715 because it was new as of yesterday. But the current line of Steigers, it goes from a 425 to a 645. And now the 715, those tractors were launched just in the spring. So they're going to be starting to be built before season of use next year. So they're all new. But on the big unit, the 715, it is track only. So when you talk about performance and profitability, we're spreading that footprint out from agronomic perspective. It's a lot of traction, a lot of capability, but we're also got a very long footprint. Actually, that undercarriage is completely redesigned for the 715. So there's a lot of things that go into that to make sure we can be as agronomically excellent as we can. We talk about agronomic design. If you walk around the lot, you see stickers on tillage tools that talk about agronomic design. And the solution has to be there from the tool to the tractor to be able to do that. The one thing that I will touch on a little bit, Natalie, is that the tractor, and from a productivity standpoint, to be able to do more across more acres with less, it's not just inputs on fuel, it's not just inputs on fertilizer, it's also inputs on labor. And that's one of the biggest challenges. So how do you do more with less people? And that's a key driver for us as well.
Yeah, that's something we talked about. You know, we've had Case, some many interviews with Case on our podcast before, and that is a topic that has come up a lot, like the farmer's time, right? Like, how valuable is that? How many of these farmers do we know that are out there for really long hours away from their family, you know, away from all the other things of their operation that need them when they're in the tractor? And so being able to give them some time back is really important. One of, you know, kind of on that note, the autonomous features of these tractors. As I said, I got to drive one on Monday. And when I say drive, I feel like I'm actually lying because I did very little driving. I got to press the throttle one time and I got to let off the clutch. And I got to do one donut, which was very impressive for how big that tractor is. I think it did a donut faster than most UTVs I've driven. But that there was actually very little driving involved. So what do those autonomous features actually look like?
So on the tractor that you drove, and we had the line set out. So we had basically a GPS line laid and a path laid. So we had a swath set up similar to what you could use on a headland on your farm. And when you got into that application, you engaged the GPS, right? And the tractor took over. We have advanced APM. So we call APM automatic productivity management. It's on all these tractors. You engage it. The tractor will select what gear and what engine RPM to most efficiently pull the tool. So you turn that on, you engage the swath, and then you use our automatic end of row. I have to watch out. I used to use the engineering terms AORT, but that sounds terrible. So
we'll
we'll use end of row turns, and it'll automatically, when it detects the boundary, you can set it program to raise the implement, do the turn for you, re-engage the implement. So it's really like single button automation. You're in the cab, you're monitoring what's happening, but the tractor is doing really a lot of the work utilizing the smart implement behind to make necessary changes for optimal agronomic performance.
So what comes to mind when I hear that a little bit is family and safety. And I think that's at the core of, you know, every operation. Those safety features, you find them in all your tractors. I mean, what's that look like from, you know, the Steiger to all the everything else Case is offering?
Safety is one of our focus five, our five key focal areas that we focus on. Safety is very, very important. I'm the father of four kids. I've got a freshman daughter. I've got a 13-year-old son. Sorry, she's 14. He's 13, eighth grader. And I've got twin fourth graders. Okay. And these kids love to come out on the farm with me and work with me. So I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but safety is very, very important because that's the most important thing in my life is those kids and my wife. And so I want to make sure that when they're operating that equipment and I'm teaching them, I'm out there working with them, is that they're safe. Right. Mm-hmm. So safety continues to be important. One of the cool things when we talk about things like automation and autonomy is really a transition as well to the type of labor we can use. So I can put my 13-year-old son out in certain applications and I could ride with him.
We don't do that in agriculture.
No. I'm with him, but he can engage certain features and be able to, you know, run them. And I know that he's going to have some extra safety built in.
Yeah, I'm glad that we did talk about the safety of it, because it is so crucial to all of us. In a little bit different direction, though, I want to go is, you know, if people want to learn more about these, like, where do we tell them? I mean, I might be taking notes for myself, too. I'm pretty excited about the electric vehicle. So where do we go to learn more about this?
I think a couple websites I'd take you to. Number one is caseh.com. You know, as of Monday morning, we had a whole bunch of press releases, a lot of things out, and it's all live on our website. So you can go see all of those things. The other thing I would tell you is, you know what, we live in an electronic world, and a lot of people look for things, and every one of us has a phone with all the, you know, information in the world on it. But also call your local Case IH dealer, because these are our dealer partners that engage with us, and we can't support customers like yourselves without our dealer partners being there every step of the way. The last one I'll give you, and this is probably just for fun, farmall100.com is the special website dedicated to 100 years of Farmall. There's some great stories out there. We're actually giving away a 75C tractor at the FFA convention coming up here in October. So it's a great way to go in and, again, celebrate a little bit about the heritage of the company, the heritage of the brand, as well as look at Farmall BEV, where we're headed forward.
I'm glad that you mentioned the dealership. We went into our Case IH dealership just last week, and I mean, you just get all of your questions answered, right? Like, I know we're personally close with our Case IH dealer, know him really well. You know, that's what happens, right? Things happen and you want to be close with your dealer. So I always recommend starting there as well. I just think you're going to get such great personal contact, even in this digital world. Another website we always tell people on the podcast is visit builtbyfarmers.com. Mm-hmm. So you guys definitely share a lot of your guys' stories. One thing that we have found time and time again with working with Case is how many of you guys farm, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so much of your company, so many of the employees truly are, you know, farmers at their heart, farming their own land. And so hearing your guys' stories is always really cool. It just makes you, you know, it feels like you're talking to a neighbor instead of like a stranger if you're going into your dealer. They probably are farming down the road from you as well. And so I always encourage people to check out that website as well.
You know, we started this out by saying you are a go-to tractor guy. So I want to make sure there isn't anything we missed about this that you would want to highlight or that people should be aware of with the Steiger.
No, I think you guys have really asked a lot of great questions, and I've really enjoyed the conversation. I just encourage the customers that are listening, you know, again, visit with your dealer, visit us online, come see where we're at. You mentioned about the number of Built by Farmers. That's something that means a lot to me. I'm from a farm, I work on. I'm free labor, right? So I'm the guy that goes.
Another thing we don't do in agriculture.
Yeah, I'm my dad and my brother utilize me when I have free time. But one thing that's really important to talk about that is that when we go out there, we know what that feels like. We know what it is. 80% of the Case IH team in North America is field based. We're out there shoulder to shoulder with customers, shoulder to shoulder with our dealers, and we are where the business is, not just sitting in the corporate office. So it is something that sets us apart as a brand, and it's something that, frankly, everybody on this lot's very proud of.